As always,
definitely.
Sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, you.
Wait, hold on. At the count of three, let's all talk at the same time.
Vagina. Oh, yeah.
Alrighty, welcome to the Rated NA podcast number 48 for the website nerdappropriate.com. It is another beautiful Saturday morning. It's actually not, well, it's kind of beautiful here. It's like 30 and cloudy though. So yeah, how are you guys doing?
It's beautiful here, I believe.
It is nice.
I don't really go outside that much, I don't know.
I did step outside and it was quite nice. That will probably be the only time I go outside today though. So what you guys been doing? It's been 2 weeks since we've done this. We took a week off,
yes,
for travels, etc. Matt came to Florida. I went to Colorado.
You did.
You know, my only exposure to Colorado in life, I went when I was 8.
Yeah,
and I just remember we camped at a cabin that had no power for like a week.
Oh,
and we roughed it when I was an 8-year-old, and I had these toys that were called Mask. You guys remember Mask?
Oh, I love Mask.
Yeah, I had all these Mask toys. So like my only memory of Colorado is basically being smelly and playing with Mask toys. And then I watched that show, Stephen King's The Stand, and Colorado is featured very heavily in The Stand. And so that's pretty much all I know about Colorado.
All right.
My only
experience sounds like the beginning of a horror movie.
Yeah.
My only experience with Colorado is I was 13 and I puked on the bridge going to the Tampa airport to fly to Colorado with my family for our big like ski trip. And that was like the beginning of the end. I spent the rest of the 2 weeks with a fever on the couch, basically barely eating grapes and drinking water and watching cartoons.
That's pretty awful.
And my brother came, like in true brother fashion, my brother came back to the cabin at one point and was like, "Ooh, skiing sucks and I hate this and I hate that," and he's like complaining to me, who's laying on a couch like half dead eating grapes and drinking water. And I was like, really you're upset that skiing sucks right now? That's your issue?
And I was like, I would trade someone feeding you grapes slowly and seductively.
Unless
you had to do it yourself,
it would have been my mom. So
that kind of destroyed my illusion that I had going there.
Oh my god!
I got really excited for a second.
It would have been my mom. So you've met her.
Oh, that's even. Gosh, now you're getting into crazy territory. Grape eating,
man. Would you?
What? Now it's even crazier. 13, mom feeding grapes.
She wasn't feeding me grapes. She was there.
Oh, okay.
We actually did do something fun while you were gone, Ash. We rode Star Tours.
First time ever. Well, not first time ever. New one, first time ever.
Awesome. Yeah, I actually went on the new one about 2 weeks ago, which is kind of weird. The week before I went to Colorado, I went on it for the first time. What? I heard every time you go, it's a different planet.
So yeah, I was gonna ask, did you only go once?
I only went once.
Yeah, you really have to do it like twice.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because you see different things.
That's... I saw Kashyyyk. Which one did you get?
We saw
Kashyyyk, yeah.
Yeah, we saw that planet. We saw sort of the space battle with Jango Fett.
Oh, cool.
The seismic bombs.
We saw pod racing.
We saw pod racing.
Ah, good old pod racing.
And
with Sebulba there.
Yes.
It was pretty good, though.
Did he use an Italian accent?
I don't think.
What are you talking about?
I don't think he spoke very much.
Because I went the first time and I was like, oh, that's cool. It's like an updated old Star Tours. And then we went the second time and like completely changed out. Like everything did. We went to
Naboo.
Person. Yeah, we had a new person. We went to Kashyyyk and Naboo, which was like, sounds like it'd be horrible. And Naboo was awesome. It was actually really fun. The ending was totally different. Like everything switched out entirely. And then I was like,
oh, wow,
that's awesome. So it was pretty cool.
Man, I do need to go back. Yeah, the wait when I went was like 40 minutes. And, you know, living in Florida, people assume that we just like we go to theme parks every 5 minutes. And I like theme parks, but living here for, you know, 20 plus years is like, okay, well, I will not wait for an hour for anything.
Yeah, you don't have to wait for anything, especially when you can just kind of go.
We also got 30 minutes before the park closed, so there was no
way. Which was awesome. It was totally awesome. That was the best idea ever.
Well, let's do a rundown of what is on Big Episode 48.
Sure. We've got Google updates that we're going to talk about. We've got old games coming back to life that we're going to talk about.
Yes.
That's Trilobite games coming back. Mass Effect's new book came out, and people went a little nuts in not good ways. Ender's Game is a book that Scott and I both love. Is getting a movie made, and there's some new cast announcements. For review, we've got yet another talk about Alcatraz, because finally all three of us have seen it.
I did.
Scott, I believe you've been playing the Trench DLC, right?
I have not.
Is it Ash?
I did. I played it. Yeah, so I'll talk briefly about it.
We've got the new Dragon Age book. I have started my Oscar movie battle round challenges, and I've got three movies that we're going to run through, and I'm picking one as the winner. We'll go over that when we get there.
I haven't seen any of those.
So I'm
interested in seeing.
I've got a new hardback deluxe edition of a comic that was on my reading list for a very long time that I finally caught up with called We Three, and a game for Android called Triple Town.
Cool.
And then finally,
I saw a movie called Triple Town once.
I don't know if I want to know what the movie was about or not, because I feel like you're going to say it was a porno.
We should maybe just move on then.
And then our Twitter question today was, have you ever met one of your idols? What would you want to? And if so, was it everything you ever hoped for?
Dun, dun, dun.
That's a great question.
It is a good question.
Thanks. All right, so let's take a quick break, and then we will come back with our explosion of news adventures.
News. That felt like a very bold announcement for me to go into the news.
Yes.
It's
very enthusiastic. So the first one is this Google privacy policy update, which I did click.
Okay.
And I did scroll through, and then I did I did just ignore. So you tell me what I ignored, and maybe.
Well, I mean, I'm gonna be honest. I don't know all of the details of the privacy policy because it is a little long and tedious to read. But essentially, what this is Google basically all of Google's services had their own privacy policy. So. Like Google Search and Gmail and YouTube and all these, like they all had separate privacy policies that you like would read through and agree to or whatever. And what Google finally did was like, hey, you know, we're pushing to the center. We're trying to get all of our things to talk to each other. It no longer makes sense for our privacy policies to be separate. So we're making one unified privacy policy that applies to all of our services. And, which sounds great. And then the thing that kind of threw waves across the internet was basically there's no opt out. So if you're not happy with the new policy, you can leave Google services. That's pretty much what they're saying at this point. And it's just a little non-Googly, I guess. That's not really how Google's ever operated previously. Like they're usually very, very forgiving with their stuff, where they'll be like, hey, if you're not cool with it, it's cool. We'll figure out another way, you know? And this was the first time they've kind of come out and been like, we're making a change, deal with it, you know? And the internet kind of exploded over it. So the actual privacy policies themselves, I don't think anything really changed too much. There were some updates to a few things with YouTube, I believe, because YouTube had always been like a completely separate service, and now they're trying to bring it in under one house. And I think there was some change to Google Plus, if I believe I'm correct. And it really wasn't anything major, but the internet just exploded over the fact that Google was changing the privacy policy and not letting you opt out. But the amazing thing to me is they were so transparent with it. They were so upfront with it. Like you said, Ash, like it appeared on almost any Google service that you would log into. There was a bar on the top that said like, hey, we're updating our privacy policy. You need to read through this and agree. It was like not like they just did it and were like, moving on. We silently now are giving out all your information to people. You know, like it just was like, hey, we're doing this. Please join in or leave. So that was it. It wasn't a super long piece, but it was something that kind of happened this week that everybody was kind of freaking out over.
Yeah, I actually I just kind of dismissed it because I was like, well, like it takes a lot for me to stop using a service or a product. Like I can, I'm a pushover. If they want to change shit around on me, 99% of the time, I'm not going to pay attention to it unless I start noticing, unless I start noticing something. Like,
right.
In all honesty, I don't care. It's so easy to get people's information if you really, really want it. It's kind of scary.
The other thing that's been a big hubbub with Google lately is this Search Plus Your World. Have you guys seen that? You know what that is?
No.
So Google implemented this new search feature called Search Plus Your World, where when you would search for something, they would tune your results to include your social circle, right? The issue,
like from Google Plus?
Yeah, that's the issue, is that your social circle didn't include Twitter and Facebook. It was basically just Google Plus, because Facebook or Google doesn't have access to using the Twitter feed or Facebook's feed like they used to.
Sure.
So what it ended up doing was basically, it was the first time Google has, you know, given you back results that pointed directly back at Google services, even if they weren't the best result for that service. So like if you searched for like Mark Zuckerberg, his Google Plus account would come back as like the number one result, as opposed to his Facebook account or his blog or his Wikipedia entry or anything that would be probably way more valid as to what you're looking for. It would return this like vacant Google Plus account that hasn't been touched in you know, 6 months for Mark Zuckerberg. And everybody was like, whoa, like, you know, Google, we use you because you're smart and you return the right things, not because you give us back your own service.
Mm.
So everybody freaked out about that. And then when the privacy policy came up and there was no opt-out, everybody was like, what is happening? I think people started to feel like this is Google taking its turn towards, you know, the evil empire of like owning everything and just doing what they want and not having to listen to you anymore. So whether that's true or not, I kind of disagree, but you know, it's possible.
I mean, is it ludicrous that Google would use its own services to supplement its search? You know, like instead of using like your Facebook results or something?
Well, right. I don't think it's ludicrous that they would do that. It's ludicrous that they would return it, basically break their own algorithm and return it as a top result, regardless of whether it was a valid result or not. You know, like if Mark Zuckerberg's Google Plus account hasn't been touched in 6 months, literally has no updates in it whatsoever,
right,
and you search for Mark Zuckerberg and that's the number one result, like that's clearly not the number one result. It's just that that's what they get back from their search and search and give it to you.
It's more about the integrity of searching,
It's more about the integrity of their core product still to this day, which is search and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like they basically just hacked their own algorithm to return their stuff first. And everybody was like, gotcha. You can turn it off. So, you know, again, it's not like Google forces you to use it, but you know.
Yeah.
It seems like it's more just like more of like an issue of just being informed when you're online, which it seems like it's becoming increasingly important just to be aware of what's happening, like with your accounts and your data.
Yeah, I'd agree.
You know, it's not necessarily like, well, let's all leave Google. I mean, really, the thing is just like be educated about what's happening.
Yeah, right? I would agree. So
indeed.
Let's move on. Scott, you posted a nostalgic article this week about a game that I remember very fondly of sitting around your house and playing for hours on end, which was Seventh Guest and 11th Hour.
Yeah, I remember we played those games like at my house and then at Adam's house, like in his parents' den. And
I think 11th Hour was the one that I remember the most.
Because that year was Seventh Guest, 11th Hour, because I remember them coming out, but I never
11th Hour is probably what, 95?
Seventh Guest came out in 1993.
Man, so this is like right. This is kind of probably when I took a little break from PC gaming and started doing heavy console stuff, because I never got into these.
It was and then Matt's right, the 11th Hour came out in 1995. I mean, pretty much this game came out sort of like in that heyday of point and click puzzle games, adventure games, you know,
Myst and stuff.
Myst, yeah. And like Sierra had a couple of games called Shivers, which were sort of in the same vein. And what was really cool about The Seventh Guest was that it used, you know, real actors superimposed on top of the 3D backgrounds to sort of tell the narrative of the game. And it was basically told as like a horror, not like a horror, more like a thriller, kind of like a spooky kind of puzzle game or whatever.
Yeah.
And that was the appeal in the puzzles. Like, some of the puzzles were hard, like hard, borderline impossible to solve. They were challenging. Like, this was back in the day before you could just jump on the internet and go like, what's the answer to this puzzle? I can't find it. You know?
Yeah. I was listening to a podcast. I want to say it might've been Feedback, but they were talking about like the difficulty of puzzles before GameFAQs and before like these walkthroughs existed. Yeah. And I remember being a kid and getting stuck, and that was it.
You're just stuck.
Game over. Stuck. That was it. You're stuck. And like, I am not, you guys know this, I'm not like a puzzle guy.
Yeah.
I would have to have friends come over and like help me through these really hard puzzles. And we would sit for hours.
Yeah.
Just like going through, like writing stuff down on notepads. Yeah. And being like, hey, if this one goes here and this one goes here. And it was like insanely challenging.
We did we did the same thing. And that's, and the cool thing about The Seventh Guest is that they would lead you to the puzzles, but they wouldn't always tell you how to solve the puzzle or what the rules were.
Yeah.
So that was half of the challenge. Like, the four of us would like sit in front of a computer and stare at like a bunch of gears and knobs and go like, okay, like what are we supposed to do in the first place?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then like the main sort of like antagonist in these games is Henry Stauff, who's like the guy that owns the mansion, who's like a I don't know, he's just a weird guy. I don't want to like say too much about the game, even though it's like 20 years old or whatever, but
don't spoil it, man.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it for anybody. But he's a weird guy, and he antagonizes you like when you can't solve the puzzles and makes fun of you and basically just pokes at you with like a sharp stick, you know, like with your frustrations or whatever. But the thing that was cool was that yesterday, The Seventh Guest and The 11th Hour were re-released on a website called .emu. And then they are, I think they're actually going to be coming out soon on Good Old Games as well.
Oh, cool.
And then when I kind of did a little more digging and found out that The Seventh Guest had already been ported to iOS, so you could get it on iPhone and iPad.
That's cool.
And I think they're going to work on getting The 11th Hour out as well.
So,
and
it's just going to be like basically a direct port. They're not like redesigning the game or...
Yeah, and that's... I don't even want it to be redesigned because of... there's some kind of... The look and feel of what those games were like back in the day are the reason why I want to see them again, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I wrote that I would love to see, just as a joke, somebody remake a cutscene from Mass Effect with, like, real-life actor video superimposed on top of, like, 3D backgrounds.
The CG needs to be bad, though, as it was in that era.
That would be pretty incredible.
There's something really, like, bizarre about, like, games from that era. Like, I think... Like
Sewer Shark and Night Trap and all those Sega CD games that were just god-awful.
Some of the Star Wars games did that, too, had real actors, like, on these, like,
that was, like, the Wild West of games, I think. You know, that was when everybody realized that this was becoming a real business, but no one knew how to make it correctly. Everybody was like, well, let's just make a bunch of stuff and see what works. And like that's why we got all these weird live action games and like odd puzzles. I think everybody was just trying to figure out the industry at the time.
Yeah. Oh my God. There was a game that like one of the games that followed The 11th Hour was a game called Tender Loving Care, which was like I described as almost like borderline Cinemax like softcore pornography at times, because it was basically like this tangled relationship that you had to investigate as like part of a psychologist kind of office thing.
Jesus.
And there was like
what a weird game.
So basically the whole game was like based in these like weird psychological tenets, and you would have to investigate these relationships, and then choices you made in the stories would like play out like enacted cutscenes, like video cutscenes. And it was just totally like totally bizarre stuff just to see it acted out. And then I found out that there actually is a Seventh Guest 3 that had a trailer that was released in 2004, and then the game never got made.
Ooh.
So in that article, I posted the trailer for The Seventh Guest
3. By the way, that wasn't a trailer. That was borderline a quarter of the game. It was like 10 minutes long. I was like, what is this?
Yeah, it really did look like a lot of this game was finished, and for whatever reason, it didn't get put out. But from what I understand, the Trilobite Games that exists today is sort of like a holding company, who the CEO is one of the original founders of Trilobite Games, and they're trying to really, like, I guess the idea is that by selling the original two games, they can drum up enough capital to release the third one. So
cool.
That's cool. That's
which
cool.
Which would be awesome, because, like, I mean, it's nostalgic, so I do want to see.
And if somebody like you is this, like, passionate about it, there's got to be, you know, at least three or four more of you in the country.
Yeah, I actually found a fan site called The 13th Doll, which was a fan site who tried to imagine what the third game would be like. Just like, you know, I think there's a System Shock 3 website, which, yeah, you know, that it'll never happen, but
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Still pretty cool. Yeah. I love when people are that, you know, into and their games.
I was going to add, if anybody wanted to know how cool Scott and I were in high school, on this is what we did on Friday and Saturday night. Was sit around his computer, me, Scott, Adam, and Andrew, and play 11th Hour until we fell asleep, essentially.
Yeah. We're smart guys. It's okay. It made us, it expanded our minds.
Made us the intelligent folk we are today.
Maybe not our social lives, but at least our cognitive functioning, I guess.
Well, I'm glad that it's coming back out. I love to see old stuff resurface. So definitely, if you were listening to this, keep your eyes out for the rebirth of Trilobite Games.
Cool. Let's talk about this Mass Effect book that just came
out. So actually, Scott was the one who tweeted this on our Twitter account. And he said, hey, you know, today Mass Effect Deception comes out. I know what I'm going to be doing during lunch. And they had a bunch of people reply back saying, are you sure you want to do that? And then within a couple hours, you know, Amazon and a bunch of other sites that do fan reviews pretty much universally agreed that this book was a major folly on the part of BioWare to kind of allow it to exist, which is kind of sad, mainly for, I mean, for not only for continuity reasons, but also just because from what I've been hearing and some of the pages I've read, it is kind of poorly written, which is kind of a shame. Well, let's go ahead and dive into. So first of all, it's called Mass Effect Deception. It's written by William Dietz, who was not the writer of the other three Mass Effect novels. And that guy was Drew Karpyshyn, who was actually one of the Mass Effect writers. So the other novels are actually written by, you know, BioWare staff, whereas this one is not. Let's kind of talk about some of the glaring inconsistencies that we've kind of stumbled across.
I don't know if you saw this, but there was actually the internet created a Google Doc that anybody could contribute to document the sort of inconsistencies with the Mass Effect universe in this novel.
Oh,
so things that were like out of canon, or things that, like, you know, alien species doing things that, like, they shouldn't be doing, or saying things they shouldn't be saying.
Wow.
Yeah. I'll see if I can find it while you describe it.
The two biggest that I stumbled across, and I haven't read it, by the way. This is all just, like, you know, third or fourth hand information at this point. But the two biggest inconsistencies that are just kind of insane is two of the main characters from the other novels. One of them is autistic and the other one is a homosexual. And this author cured the girl of autism and made her grow out of it, which you can't really do. And that's sort of a slap in the face of autism in general. And the homosexual character no longer is a homosexual. It's not mentioned, and he readily is flirting with the opposite sex, as if that homosexuality also faded away.
God.
So those are some big ones. And then, of course, there's, like, literally, you know, dozens of minor ones as well. So,
wow. So was there a reason Karpyshyn was pulled off the novel? Is he busy with Mass Effect 3 and just couldn't do this in time? Well, or
they pulled Karpyshyn and they put him to work on the Star Wars universe. So he's actually, from what I understand, down in Austin working on the Old Republic content. So that's what he's
doing. You didn't
already
say that, did you? Because I totally missed it.
No, I didn't already say that. No, that's from what I understand. That's where he is. But it's definitely interesting. My question for you guys is, why do you think this was allowed to kind of slide through the tracks? You think that maybe BioWare just has too much going on to really...
Yeah, that was actually my first question to Scott. I was like, why did they let this out? Like, if it's so glaringly bad, why did this even happen in the first place? I have a feeling I'd be willing to bet that it's actually it happened because there's some contracts going on with the publisher and with BioWare where they were required to have X amount of novels put out in the time that Mass Effect was going to be running. And that if they didn't get this out in time for the game, that they would break a contract with the publisher. So they pulled the writer, put somebody on that we could get it done, and, you know, rushed it out. It happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Contractual obligation edition.
Yeah.
Soon. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a what feeling. Stuff, I mean, that's not verified by any information. It's just usually what happens with, like, when shitty albums come out from bands, you know, or when shitty movies come out from directors, like a lot of times what's happening is they're just like, ah, fuck it. I have to do one more. Here's your one more. And you're like, oh God, this is a turd. What's going on? So.
Yeah, there's okay. So I'm looking at this Google doc. I posted a link for you guys.
Awesome.
So there's like, okay, it's broken down into different types of errors. So there's a section called errors, lore. And then under lore, there's, I don't know, 41 things that are mentioned. Jeez. Under timeline, there's like 7 things. Technology, there's 15 things. Characters, 17 errors. And then just like...
can you read some of them for us?
Yeah.
Some of the big ones?
So the disclaimer says, while this list may seem nitpicky considering some of the errors, there are a handful worth mentioning that have very legitimate reasons for being upset over. This includes a character's growing up from being autistic, turning Mass Effect's only gay male character straight and then killing him, and being literally impossible to reconcile with the timeline made by the games, comics, and books. And then, so like the list, okay, so the, just to read down the list, the Citadel is described as being star-shaped. There's a Bartarian embassy.
The Citadel's described as being star-shaped?
Yeah, and then it says, well, whilst the Citadel does have 5 arms arranged around a ring, even when it is fully open, the arms are not in the same plane as the central ring. Rather, they are oriented straight onward. But, I mean, like, so they what they've done in this document is they've highlighted in red errors that are, like, of a significant magnitude. And then highlighted in blue, sort of like level 2 errors. And then everything else is just like, you know, you might describe as being more nitpicky or whatever. So
the good news, though, and they have it at the top of the document, is that I guess BioWare responded.
Yes.
And basically said, hey, you guys are right. Thank you for being so active and passionate about it. We are going to revisit the novel. I mean, I'll briefly, it says, the teams at Del Rey and BioWare would like to extend our sincerest apologies to the Mass Effect fans for any errors and oversights made in the recent novel Mass Effect Deception. We are currently working on a number of changes that will appear in future editions of the novel.
Yeah, the only thing that I'm not, I mean, I've only read about half the book, and the thing that I can't really reconcile is how they're going to fix the stuff with Jillian, who her and the other biotic character from the Academy, I think have aged maybe like 2 or 3 years more than they should have given the timeline.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know how you could like still rewrite the book and then make her like autistic again, because she's like doing a lot in the book. You know what I mean? Has a lot of dialogue, making a lot of decisions, kind of like out on her own doing things. Like I don't see how you can reconcile some of the more significant errors and have the book still, I don't know. It seems like it would require a major revision.
You know what's amazing to me, like,
throw out the first edition.
What's amazing to me is that this is like the third thing I've heard about in recent couple of weeks where the internet has affected change in the real world, where like we had SOPA and PIPA, you know, that we talked about last podcast, where the internet just went into uproar and basically got those two bills pulled entirely. You know, here's a book that's filled with a bunch of errors that pisses off the community that loves it, you know, and spends a lot of money on this stuff, and they managed to get a response from the company who says, hey, we're sorry, we screwed up, we're gonna fix it.
Wow.
So it's kind of cool. It's a cool thing to see the internet be able to have this power, even on from a large scale to a small scale like this, where they're like, hey, we're not happy with this, like this makes us really mad, we spend money on these products that we love. So last up in news really quickly, a book that Scott and I both hold pretty dear to our hearts, Ender's Game, is getting made into a movie. We haven't really talked about it yet, and one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up is because, well, today they announced that Viola Davis, I believe is her name, from The Help, right?
I don't see her listed.
Yeah, Slash Film dropped it, like, yesterday.
Oh, okay.
So she might not be on IMDb yet. But Viola Davis is going to be one of the, I think it's her name. Either that or I'm saying the wrong name over and over again. It's going to be one of the like psychologists on the ship.
Oh, okay.
They didn't say who specifically, but that's the kind of character they said she's going to be playing. But what's interesting about this movie to me, because I actually think this could be a really cool movie, the fear I have...
Are you concerned?
Yeah, I have a concern. I have a pretty major concern.
I do too.
Is it...
You can go ahead and say it, though.
Is your concern Gavin Hood? Because that's my concern.
Oh, no, I was going to say... I don't even know what that's in reference to. Oh, the director? My concern is, what is this movie going to be rated?
Yeah.
And is it going to be for kids?
So it is Viola Davis, and she is a psychologist on the ship. So here's my concern. I agree, Scott. The problem I have with it is that Gavin Hood's only claim to fame, the only title he has under his belt that's a major movie, was Wolverine, the first X-Men. Or Wolverine, the whatever that fucking turd of a movie was. Or X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Okay.
Which... is not a very good movie.
Yeah.
Like, technically.
Yeah, it's a movie.
It also shit all over some major characters in the Marvel Universe, like Deadpool, for one.
Mm-hmm.
So that concerns me a little bit.
Okay.
The only good thing is that Orson Scott Card is attached as a writer for the screenplay, so
my concern was more of like the rating of the movie, because some of the stuff that happens in this book is pretty heavy,
yeah,
both like physically and emotionally, and I would just hate to see like that this movie ended up being like PG-13 and was like pretty watered down.
Well, I would say that the cast looks pretty awesome. Like Viola Davis is awesome. Yeah. Harrison Ford as Colonel Graf is awesome. Abigail Breslin as Valentine is awesome. Ben Kingsley as Mazer Rackham. Like the people that they're putting in some of the important roles, I think are really well cast. So
yeah, seems like
hopefully
it makes
that
sense.
Pans out. We'll just have to wait and see. But I'm excited. You know, I'll see it. I just hope that Gavin Hood
kind of makes me want to read the book again.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, there's a couple people at work reading it right now, and I'm like super excited they're reading it. And there's a deluxe edition of the graphic novel coming out soon too. So,
oh, cool,
very cool.
But yeah. So that was just a quick hit, and I didn't know if you'd seen this news about the movie yet, Scott. So that's kind of why I brought it up for
that's awesome.
Selfish reasons of you and I.
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back with some reviews.
Woot!
So we're back, and Ash has finally watched a show that I sadly have fallen very behind on. So we can.
Oh, that is sad.
Yeah, it is.
So we're talking about J.J. Abrams' Alcatraz.
So how many episodes did you watch?
4.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, so is that caught up, or is it 5 now?
I watched all of them. Yeah, I'm caught up.
I think I've watched 3 of them then, or at least I have one more to watch.
The last one was really, really, really good.
It's good because I have questions about where they go. So let's. I want to hear your opinion, though, what you thought of the show.
Cool. So I really enjoy it. It definitely takes a page. Has the same pretty much formula as Lost. There are flashbacks to the 1960s, you know, Alcatraz, and then you get to see a little bit about the various inmates and. You know, characters that existed in the past and kind of how they relate to the characters in the present. And for those that are listening to this that haven't heard us talk about Alcatraz, it's pretty much split into 2 timelines. The main premise is that criminals that existed in Alcatraz all vanish along with, you know, everyone that worked there. And now all of a sudden, they all vanish in, I think, 1963, and they all start reappearing slowly in present time but they all have like these evil, like nefarious jobs that they're out doing for some secret, like clandestine organization. So they're out like running around shooting people and stabbing babies and doing terrible stuff. And of course, a task force is assembled that doesn't really have a name. And it consists of a comic book writer who's also an Alcatraz expert, a female detective who is like loosely tied to the inmates, and also a doctor and a sort of James Bond-esque secret agent type guy are all in this organization. But it's cool. They like track these villains and they pretty much followed their same MO as the past. You know, they're doing the same crimes that they did when they were in the 1960s. And whoa. Sorry, there's a strange cattail in one of the windows here. So anyway, yeah, it's really good. I'm really, really enjoying it. I think I watched it with Christina and she actually almost cried at one of the moments where I'm gonna call him Hurley just because I don't know his name in Alcatraz, but Hurley gave like a very moving speech. Yeah. And I think she has a crush on him, so she was very like moved by it.
I think they could just call him Doc in it, you know.
Doc, yeah. We'll just call him Doc.
Yeah. So do you like it? Are you into it?
I'm really into it. I think it's great. It's a lot of fun. Like I haven't watched like a drama in a really long time.
Oh, really?
Constantly. And I don't know what happened. Like after season 7 of 24, I kind of like shut down a little bit, and I was like, I just can't watch any more of these, you know, shows. And after Heroes took such a shit, I was just like, I just kind of got turned off. So I don't really watch too many dramatic.
Is it staying kind of Monster of the Week? I mean, are they going after a new bad guy every week?
Yeah. Usually the format of like these Abrams shows, especially with, because I watched Undercovers and I watched I'm like losing
Fringe,
my thoughts, but
Alias.
Yes, Fringe. Thank you, Fringe. That's what I was thinking of. Like what generally tends to happen with these shows is that the first season is really just like gets you into the groove of what's happening. And they don't start like unraveling like parts of the super arc until like later in the first season or at the beginning of the second season. So they'll start to show you things of like the big arc, but they won't like really dive into it until like they get a bunch of people hooked through like normal episodes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like the first season of Fringe was like definitely Monster of the Week, X-Files style. It was just like solve a mystery, move on to something else. You know what I mean? And they didn't really have any bearing on like what sort of like the whole purpose of the show's story was. So that, I mean, yeah, right, what it is right now is that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's good though, because I that's what's going to keep me kind of coming back. I can't do like what lost me on Lost.
Yeah.
Was that like, I think probably around season 3 or 4 when it was actually when I started kind of really watching. It turned into this big, like, year-long arc. Like, it was like, no longer was it like every few episodes things were happening. It was like these gigantic arcs that I just was like, I can't keep with this every week. It's just not, I have too much else going on to concentrate on a TV show for 6 months at a time, you know?
Yeah, that's where Fringe is right now, but Fringe is in its fourth season. And, you know, at this point, you're either invested in it or you're not. And I think that's why once these shows get ramped up, you're either like kind of locked in or you've already moved on to something else.
Yeah. So I think what's good news is that this show is definitely on all of our watch lists now, right?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Of course.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Awesome.
It should also be noted, and I think we brought this up before, but the lead actress is actually from Orlando.
Yeah, that's what you were saying. Oh, cool. Yeah.
She actually, according to Christina, she may have played lacrosse against my wife because they graduated the same year, and my wife graduated from Oviedo High School in 01, and Sarah Jones graduated from Winter Springs High School also in 01.
Ah.
And I think they were both
mortal enemies.
So Matt.
Yes.
I used to be like a movie guy.
Yes.
And in recent years, I've kind of grown to hate movies.
Yes.
Because they've all been really bad.
Right.
So there are movies that are up for these things called Oscars.
Correct.
Which is supposedly some sort of award that you give that does not involve hot dogs. And
the cheesiest joke
that was awesome.
You have made in a very long
I like
time.
That. I like it.
the movies that are up for Oscars right now are Moneyball, Midnight in Paris, and Tree of Life, and none of which I've seen. So why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of a rundown?
Well, actually, so this year, so last year the Oscars, God, their website's horrible. The Oscars last year switched and had this new layout of 10 movies that could be up for Movie of the Year, right? And I made a goal of like, I'm going to watch them all before the Oscars. And then I failed miserably at the goal. And I watched, I think, 4 of them before the Oscars, which was more than I expected to. But anyway. So this year what they did, they tweaked it a little and they said, all right, here's what we're going to do. I think there was a minimum of 5 movies that would be in the top best movie of the year and a maximum of 10. And then based on the voting, and they had to reach a certain percentage. And if they hit that percentage, then they would get entered into the best movie of the year. So this year there's actually 9. It's The Artist, The Descendants, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, The Help, Hugo, Midnight in Paris, Moneyball, The Tree of Life, and War Horse. So I set up my challenge again, and this time I'm doing it a little different. I'm going to get an article up this weekend. I didn't have time last night when I started doing this. But basically what I'm going to do is have a battle. We're going to set up a tree, and there's going to be three movies against three movies against three movies, and then the winner of each one of those three will go up into the next round, and they'll go up against each other, and then we'll finally have my choice for what I think will be the Oscar movie of the year. You guys are welcome to watch them or watch what I tell you to watch, but either way. So round one was Moneyball, starring Brad Pitt, and Superbad, whatever his name is. I'm going to look it up right now while I'm talking. Jonah Hill?
Yeah.
And it is about the Oakland A's in the early 2000s and how they basically hired an economist from Yale, which is Jonah Hill's character, to figure out baseball by the numbers and build a team with minimal amount of money that has the most chance of success. This sounds like
in terms of player cost, like how much it costs to so basically it's like major league, but reality. Well, so they get all these shitty players that are kind of good.
This is a true story. Like, this actually happened. So
instead of like high profile players, they would look at statistics for individual players and then use those statistics to beat the other teams.
And what spurred this was they had three of like basically the best players in the league in like 2001. And when 2002 hit, all three of those players went free agent, and all three of them got bought by much bigger teams. One by Boston, one by New York, and the other one by New York. I think New York got two of them, and Boston got one of them. And the point that they made kind of early on was like, hey, look, we're a small market team. We don't make a lot of money. There's no way we can compete with the Yankees. Like, we can't play their game. They're going to beat us. They have like millions of dollars more than us to spend every year. There's no way we can say, all right, well, we're going to play the Yankees the same way the Yankees play us, which is just buy the best team you could possibly buy and then just destroy with it, which is how baseball kind of works. And so they hire this guy. They have this theory of how it's going to go down. And basically the movie follows Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill and the decisions they make to make this team a winning team with the least amount of money. It sounds like a horribly boring movie, and I'll talk about it in a minute, because really it's about – if you break it down, it's about baseball, which is not the most exciting sport in the world. Statistics, which is not the most exciting thing in the world. And then a little bit about personal relationships. The second movie I watched is Woody
also
Collins.
Not the most exciting thing in the world, might I add.
The second movie I watched was Woody Allen's latest movie, Midnight in Paris. It's starring Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams, and then a slew of other people who show up as different characters in the movie. And it basically follows Owen Wilson as this writer, Gil, who goes to Paris with his fiance to visit with her parents who are there. And he every night at midnight, he goes out for a walk, and he gets picked up by this old 1920s car. And then it transports him back to the 1920s Paris. And he has run-ins with like F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, Pablo Picasso, like all of these, the Renaissance of the 20s, all the art that was coming out of the 20s. He runs into these people, and it kind of inspires him to be a better writer. And it's very much a Woody Allen film. There's a lot of talking, but so we'll get into that one, but that's the premise of that. And it's kind of about this writer deciding what he really wants out of life, I guess. And through the kind of meme of him going back to the '20s. And then the final movie I watched is a movie called Tree of Life, which is the latest movie from the art house director. Oh, I always screw up his name. Let me say it correctly. Terrence Malick. It's starring, and I say starring loosely, Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, and Jessica Chastain. And it's about the beginning of time all the way through the end of the universe.
And that sounds amazing.
Follows a family in the 1950s that has a death in the family, I think. So we'll get into that one in a minute too. So what I want to do is these three movies went up against each other. I'm going to pick the winner. I'm going to tell you guys the winner first, and then I'll briefly talk. Or do you want me to talk about the movies first and rate them and how they were? Because you're going to know which one I picked by the way I talk about them. So what do you want
to? I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that you liked Moneyball the best.
You are correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it just seems sort of up your alley.
The premise.
And I heard the performances in that are actually really solid.
Moneyball is fucking fantastic, and I did not expect anything out of it. I thought it was going to be not that great. I'm not a big Brad Pitt guy. Like, the last movie I really loved Brad Pitt in was, like, Fight Club, you know? Like, which is just a bro movie. Like, it was, like, totally not for any other reason. And I'm just not, it's not that he's bad. I'm not all about him.
He's Zach Morris.
What?
I mean, he's Zach Morris. I mean, from Saved by the Bell. He's that cocky, like, super dude. You know what I mean? Yeah.
But it was written extremely well. It was directed really well. Like, even the cinematography was, like, really gorgeous. They do a lot of awesome shots from the baseball field with the lighting, like, really dramatic lighting. And they mix in real footage from the games that was actually happening. So, like, they would show a scene where, like, the pitcher throws a ball, and then they would flip out and show, like, actual footage of the hit that would happen or the home run that would happen or something along those lines. And it's just – for all of the boring components – the story is super interesting, and for anyone, I don't think you have to like baseball. I don't think you have to be into math. It's just a really interesting kind of underdog story about this team that figured out a way to not have to compete with the people that they knew they couldn't beat. You know, I mean, they basically just said, fine, if you're going to just buy your way to winning, we're going to figure out another way, and we're just going to go a completely opposite direction. And we'll just see what happens. And like at one point in the movie, it's, you know, of course going poorly, and he just kind of goes, well, we're either going to do it or we're not, you know, and they just kind of full on go for it. And it's just a really awesome story of this team. There was a lot, cause I didn't know much about the Oakland A's at the time. The only thing I knew was they made it to the playoffs like miraculously, and I didn't know why. But it's just a really good movie, just a really solidly good movie. I don't know how else
awesome
it, but I definitely recommend it. It's worth, you know, I would even say it's worth renting, honestly. It's a really good movie. It's worth the $5-6 that you might spend renting it.
So do you want to preview what is your bracket for next time? Have you selected the other three?
I want to talk about the other two movies really quickly.
Okay.
Midnight in Paris. Owen Wilson plays Woody Allen and almost to a T. It's crazy. He acts and talks just like Woody Allen. He everything he's doing, it's like he became Woody Allen for this movie. Midnight in Paris is actually really good. I just don't think it's an Oscar winning movie. It's gorgeously shot, because Woody Allen always kind of like makes these, you know, love scenes to whatever city the movie, it's usually New York, but whatever city the movie takes place in. And this one is in Paris, and it's just gorgeously shot in Paris. The interactions with all of the old writers and the old artists is really interesting. The premise is pretty good. It's just not, to me, it's not like, it's a Woody Allen movie. You know, it's hard to say like this is the Oscar winner. It's just kind of like an entertaining movie. Mm-hmm. And then Tree of Life, I don't know what I watched for 2.5 hours. I really have
all of Terrence Malick's shit is like that. I remember being so excited for Thin Red Line.
Yeah,
because I'm a big war buff, and like I remember watching like Trees Flow and like Monkeys Jump Around for like 45 minutes straight.
Thin Red Line,
endless shots.
Thin Red Line was a Thin Red Line was a more coherent story than Tree of Life. If that blows your mind at all, it starts out and you're watching this family, and from what I presume, one of the sons dies in war, I think, and then you watch the universe for about 45 minutes. Literally, I like was watching Planet Earth and universe shows from like whatever channel they was, AMC or whatever they ran on Discovery or whatever. Like that's what I watched for the next 45 minutes. There was no talking. It was just scenes of the universe and then scenes of animals and dinosaurs. I watched dinosaurs for a little bit.
What?
And all then right. And then it came back to the family, and it's kind of following Sean Penn, who's older. But everybody's just, like, muttering words. Like, it'll show people, and they'll just be like, bazoo, bazoo, and they'll, like, whisper things. And, it was so art housey. I just couldn't.
Is this the movie that doesn't have a lot of talking in it?
Tree of Life?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's almost no talking in it.
Because I heard somebody talk about a movie lately and said that they walked out.
Oh no, that's The Artist. The Artist is a silent movie, which I think
No. I think there was another movie. I know what you're talking about.
Great. I love this new trend of not talking in movies.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, it's not important.
So basically, if you want to watch a really gorgeous movie and just mute it and not even worry about what the fuck is going on inside of it at all, because there's no, it's almost incoherent as to what's happening until the last, like there's a third of it that actually follows the family really closely. I'm like too much of a populist guy. I kind of don't get into these art housey movies, and this one was just beyond even Thin Red Line. It was like, I just watched it and I was like, okay, turned it off. And that, I don't know what the hell I just watched for 2 hours.
Yeah. You're like, that just happened.
So the next round I have is, that's not on the list. Hold on. Is Hugo, Warhorse, and The Artist.
Cool. We're going to talk about those next week, or you want to keep doing this for the next 3 weeks?
Yeah, I'm going to do it for the next 3 weeks, and the fourth week will be the final, and then Oscars happen a week later. So
awesome. Perfect.
So the next week is, Warhorse, The Artist, and Hugo. So if you guys, anybody else wants to see any one of those, we'll be talking about them next week, and I'll make a pick out of that one. But for round one, Moneyball versus Midnight in Paris versus Tree of Life, Moneyball is the winner.
Cool. Ash, you played the new Iron Brigade DLC this week?
Yeah, we were supposed to play together, but then I realized that the game has to download a whole all over again to kind of rebrand it, to move it from Trenched to from Trench to Iron Brigade. It's not just a palette swap.
I think
on the title screen.
Yeah, I think if you hadn't played Trenched since the game switched to Iron Brigade, and then you go to buy this DLC, you basically have to re-download the original game and then add the DLC on top of it.
Yes, so it was actually like a 2 gigabyte download that I had to get before we played that night.
Wow.
So I ended up conking out at like 8 o'clock, and Scott and I didn't get a chance to play. But I did wake up early this morning and got it all installed and had a good old time with it. Now, this takes place after the events of the first Trench story. But the thing that's cool about this is you actually take off and you fly to Mars on the McKinley. So McKinley is an aircraft carrier. They build some special crap on it, and they put like a dome on it. They fly it into space, and you crash land on Mars, and then you have like a whole new set of adventures. The same gameplay is back. The level cap is increased. I want to say – I'm probably saying this wrong. But it's probably, I think, level 15 is the new level cap from level 10. This is hard though, guys. This is
really,
no
really
joke. Yeah, like I got through the first, and I had golded every single mission in Trenched. I had a gold ribbon, I guess, and I got through the first two okay. I think I got only bronze though.
Were you trying to solo them?
Yeah, I'm soloing them now. And then I hit the third one, and I tried the third one like 6 or 7 times, and I can't beat it. the map is just so big. It requires, and you get attacked from all angles, and there's three different defense points, and it's just like it almost requires you to have a full team.
Well, that's awesome.
To beat it. And I think it's like 15 different waves that you have to survive.
Oh, there's like a horde mode now, right? Like a more like a survival mode.
Yeah, I haven't tried it yet, but they did add Double Fine did add a horde mode. You know, survival. I haven't gotten a chance to do it yet, but you get to bring in your customized trenches and stuff like that.
I think they added that to the original game as well, not just this particular DLC.
I think that was the first piece they put out.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the first piece of DLC. So it's cool. I've already discovered some new chassis that are really, really slick looking.
Are they all, since you're on Mars, are they all, like, internal now? Like, you sit inside of the mech or no?
Oh, no, no. They're not yeah. that fancy. You can yeah. get a space suit as your, like, guy's suit with a domed helmet, which is what I'm wearing right now because it makes sense. But the chassis that I have are a little bit more futuristic looking. They have some lights and stuff on them. Some of the guns, the new guns I've unlocked, are a little bit more like high tech. Like they have a lot of like one of the big cannons, the three slot cannons, has an effect where it soaks up all the money. So like you shoot the cannonball and then it has like a little gravimetric pulse that soaks in money and gives it to you.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
Yeah. And so there's just like a lot of new tweaks to weapons and things like that, which are pretty awesome. But definitely if you were a fan of Trenched, this is just more, you know, more Trenched. New enemy types, much more difficult enemy types. It's kind of like ridiculous. Like you remember like the Big Daddy thing, the big walking like
yeah.
colossus that would slowly kind of lumber across the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's things that are like bigger than that now that are kind of like bipedal, like, you know, walking destruction towards your base.
Nice.
But it's definitely good. I think it's only 400 Microsoft points.
Yeah,
I want
it's
to say
$5.
Right,
I thought it would be 10.
Oh wow!
But
yeah,
kudos to Double Fine. Yeah,
definitely. It
for
is
sure.
very, very.
And
worth
I have
the
my new hard drive installed, so I will be picking.
Oh,
it up.
You finally got that?
Yeah, yeah. That's why I play Kings awesome. Of Amalur and all that. I put the new hard drive on.
And I feel like anytime we talk about Double Fine, I really always want to mention the other downloadable games that they have because they're just so fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
which would be Costume Quest and Stacking.
Yeah,
yeah,
and they're both good for different reasons.
Stacking
but it
was
just...
PS3 only, right? Or is it on Xbox? I thought
it's on Xbox.
It is
as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
But man, they're both good, and it's like sort of like that creative energy of like Double Fine, like as a studio and all the people that work there, and sort of like their personalities and like the humor and stuff, and like if you like Iron Brigade, like. You got to try the other games just because they're
awesome.
They're awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Their new game did come out this Tuesday as well. I haven't got a chance to try out their Kinect game, but the
it looks like a game sort of geared towards families, I believe. Like something about like Kinect something with movies in it. Let me see.
Yeah, it's called I think Happy Action Theater.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, Happy Action
yeah.
Theater, and it's like 15 different 10 or 15 different mini games, all which use the Kinect camera to allow you to do like crazy crap, like swim through lava.
Don't they make a movie
and, like,
out of it though?
Yeah, they just make like you could basically just use your Kinect as like a bizarro party tool. I don't know if you guys remember Epcot. Well, of course Scott does, but remember we went to the Figment's World?
Yeah,
and you would have to do those different like
my favorite
you would
ride.
Be superimposed on the green screen. Mm-hmm. And they would make you like go through that entire adventure. That's kind of what I think Happy Action Theater is.
That's awesome.
So, cool. So we'll check that out probably next week. I'm assuming one of us will download it.
I will.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, why not?
Cool.
I'll sit here all by myself, forever alone, playing my movie Kinect game. So this right here that no one else can see except you guys is a graphic novel hardcover. It's called the Deluxe Edition. Of a story called We Three. It's Grant Morrison writing and Frank Quietly illustrating, which is kind of an awesome team. Grant Morrison you either like or don't like. It depends on what he writes for me. And then Frank Quietly is just a fucking amazing artist. He does amazing work pretty much constantly. And what this story about really fast is, or what the story is about really fast is the government basically engineered new weapons, and it's a cat a dog and a rabbit that are in these like small mech suits that have been programmed to fight, essentially. And what they're looking at doing is like replacing soldiers on the field so they can remote control these animals that are basically just have become killing machines to go out on the battlefield and just decimate whatever their enemy is, or do like stealth kills. And that it opens up with the cat doing taking out, like assassinating a dictator from a different country.
Okay.
It is so much fun. It's a really awesome read. It's Grant Morrison kind of at his best when he deals with these weird twists on reality of like things that the, you know, government's doing or whatever. I think he does the best when he kind of stays in reality somewhat. And that's what this is. It's not superhero-y at all. It has nothing to do with any of the real characters. It's short. This is the only book in the series. It's not anything massive.
Oh, wow.
It's the deluxe edition. I definitely recommend it. Comes the paper's really nice that they print on. The cover is like a matte kind of finish with 25 pages of like extra artwork in the back and concepts that Frank Quietly did for all the different mech suits. The voices that these characters have are just, it's just written really well. Like the animals are all like, they can speak. And that's what freaks everybody out at the beginning. Like when this general comes to see them and they can talk and they kind of like reason, but they still reason on the level that a dog would reason or that a cat would reason. Like it's not like all of a sudden they're like super intelligent. They just like, they're like, dog good, like, like weird things like that. And then the cat like hates everyone. Like the cat's like keeps saying like everybody smells and stuff. It's really humorous how they talk, and you end up like really loving these characters. And it's all about how they're gonna get decommissioned and basically killed, and the animals are like programmed to survive, and they break out of the government facility and just like run rampant for three issues of comics. And you kind of read about how they're trying to chase these animals down and what happens at the end. And it's like weirdly heartwarming. It's written really well, and the art is fantastic. It's a really cool story. I think you can get this actual edition. It came out last year. I think you can get this one on Amazon for like $15 right now, which is totally worth it. It's definitely worth that price. So
awesome.
Check it out. It was on my reading list for a long time. I missed it in the single issues, and I was like, I have to pick it up on trade. And it's called We Three. It's by Grant Morrison and Frank Quietly. And it is a definitely awesome comic to pick up and read.
Sounds really cool.
Yeah. It's unique. It's like, you don't read stuff like it's, and it was put out by Vertigo, which is DC's kind of independent imprint. So definitely worth it. Nice. Check it out. We Three, the deluxe edition.
Cool.
Sweet. All right. So I tend to read a lot when I travel, just because it's the only time I can really focus. And I finally got around to reading this, which is Dragon Age Asunder.
Which our listeners also cannot see.
Yes, I'm showing them a picture of Asunder.
That looks like a humongous tome of knowledge. Yeah.
It is a huge book. It's 415 pages of a pretty small font. So it's a little hefty sucker. And I did a full review of Asunder on nerdappropriate.com, and a lot of you guys have probably already checked that out, which I appreciate greatly. But Asunder's really cool because the rest of the Dragon Age books are all prequels to the games. They all take place, you know, many, many years before the events of Dragon Age 1. But Asunder actually takes place right after Dragon Age 2. So you get to kind of see what's going on in the world following like all the terrible stuff that went down in 2. And for those that haven't, you know, I'm going to do a little spoiler warning here, Matt, so you may want to take your headphones off for a couple seconds, but
yar.
I have the memory of a dog. I'll forget it.
Okay, so it's Dragon Age 2. Dragon Age 2 ends with basically the Chantry, who's
I also have no idea what you're talking about. So it's
okay. So the Chantry is like the church in the Dragon Age who worship the divine, and then the military arm of the Chantry are the Templar. And then, of course, there are the mages, and the Templar, their job is to watch the mages at all times because the mages have a past history of violence and of losing control. And in the Dragon Age universe, mages are like constantly tempted by the dark side, or like by basically being taken over by demons and stuff like that. So the Templar watch over them constantly. So at the end of Dragon Age 2, all this shit goes down, and there's like a on the verge of a world war between the Templar and the Circle of the Magi or the Mages. This picks up, like I said, right after those events go down, and it takes place in Orlais. And it is pretty much a giant story about how the next game is going to be nothing but a massive world war. It is really, really building towards an absolute sort of apocalypse. The thing that's really neat is it does introduce a whole lot of new characters, and I am going to name some characters here. So there's Reese, and Reese is actually the child of one of the main characters from the first Dragon Age game, who I can't really, for spoiler reasons, I don't want to give away. So Reese is actually related to someone from Dragon Age 1. There is a new knight captain by the name of Evangeline, and Evangeline is probably the strongest character in the book. She's really reminiscent of she's very conflicted, because she's torn between her duty and what's right and what's wrong, because she wants, you know, the mages to have this freedom, but at the same time, you know, she at the same time is sworn to protect society. So she's kind of in this really rough place, but she's an incredible character, really well written, and the book is pretty much just about her. So all new character really focuses on her, and there are a lot of other alumni returning from the first game. I don't want to give it away, because they're all kind of revealed in the book as like big surprises, but there are definitely some really fun returning characters from Dragon Age Origins that you don't expect to turn up, and all of a sudden they're there and they're kind of along for the ride. So you have a new cast of characters kind of intermingling with this old cast, it is a great adventure. It takes a while to get started. It's like, you know, probably about page 60 or page 70, it starts really rolling. And once it starts rolling, it doesn't really let up. It's very, very fast. But great action scenes, a lot of death, a lot of destruction, a great fantasy adventure story, you know, dragons, demons, monsters, all that fun stuff. So definitely, if you're a fan of Dragon Age or of fantasy in general, this was written by David Guider, who wrote all the Dragon Age novels, and he's the main writer for the games as well. So this isn't the same problem as Mass Effect Deception. This is like a legitimate Dragon Age story that actually is, you know, part of the whole Dragon Age arc.
How many Dragon Age novels have there been?
This is the fourth one.
Cool.
Yeah, this is the fourth. Is it the fourth one or the third one? Man, I'm totally brain farting now. This might be only the third one. Yeah, right. I think it's the third one. My apologies. Yeah. I for some reason, I thought there were four. Oh, also, I should say, in my review, I was talking to someone who's kind of become our buddy online, at HemiArt, and her name's Beth Westmoreland, and she actually did an original piece just for our review, which was really super nice of her. And
that's awesome, too.
She did it for nothing but high fives. So definitely go ahead and virtual high fives. Definitely go ahead and add her on Twitter. It's at HemiArt. She's an awesome artist, and you can check her work out at nerdappropriate.com if you do a search for Dragon Age Asunder. She did a piece on Evangeline, which is cool.
Awesome. Nice.
Yep.
Yeah.
So last up, and this will be pretty quick. I like to highlight games on Android, because the Android marketplace for games is so kind of slim. It's not very deep pickings for games. So when I pick something up and I really enjoy it, I like to try to share it. And the latest one is a game called Triple Town. It's made by Spry Fox, I believe is their name. It is kind of in the vein of Spry Fox. In the vein of some of the Facebook style games, where you kind of have like a limited amount of turns to do something, and then, you know, you can buy more turns if need be. I have not actually hit that, and I've been playing it for a week solid, so I've not spent anything yet. But the premise of the game is you have a grid on the field of spaces that you can drop items, and you kind of build this town up out of these items that you drop. And every time you drop three of the same next to each other, they combine into like the next level of whatever the chain is. So like you have grass that can combine into a bush, that can combine into a tree, that can combine into a house, that can combine into a mansion, that I think combines into a castle. I haven't gotten that good yet with it. So it's kind of like a crazy puzzle game that you're dropping all these items down and combining them into bigger items. And then there's what they call some kind of bear that you drop on the field. And the bears basically block you from dropping stuff and they move. So while you're trying to drop grass, they'll like move in the way and you can't build the patterns that you're trying to build. And then if you block the bears in and they can't move any further, they die and they make a gravestone. And then you can combine those gravestones to make a church. And then you can combine the church to make bigger churches. And it just keeps growing and getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
So how does this work with, like you said, there's a limited number of turns and you pay for more turns?
Yeah, so do you
play in real time or what?
Yeah, you play in real time. You drop as much, like I sit on the train and just play for like 45 minutes. And you start out, when you download the game, you get something like 2,000 drops that you can do, or 4,000 drops. So it's a ton. Mm-hmm. Like the game's free, and the moment you download it, it's not like there's any limited gameplay immediately. Like I played for probably 4 days before I ran out of turns. And basically you have those 4,000 or 2,000 turns to drop stuff. It goes really fast, and then you can earn coins by doing well. So every time you beat a level, which means you filled the level up entirely, there's nowhere else to drop anything, it'll end. It kind of assesses your play and then gives you coins, and you earn points in Faint if you're part of Faint, which is one of the game, you know, market, not marketplaces, game, what do you call it? It's like Xbox Live, where you can track your friends and see all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's like a social system.
You use your coins to buy stuff, and you can buy more turns with the coins. So essentially, if you time it correctly or you do well enough, you kind of don't have to buy with real money anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I am now, I've been playing for a week solid, and I just hit a point where like I've run out of turns and I've spent all of my coins. Cause you start out with coins too. They give you like 1,000 or 2,000 coins.
Is there no way to recover from that once your like resources have been depleted? Or
well, you earn back, so over time you earn back turns.
Oh, so if you don't play for like a week.
Yeah, if I didn't touch it for a week, I'd have like another 2,000 turns. And if I don't play overnight, I end up with like 100 turns in the morning. Like it's really not limiting. Like they let you play the game, which is probably why it's so addicting and fun, is that I don't feel like they were like, here's a free game, now give us $10. Like that didn't happen at all. But I will say that the game is so much fun and so kind of addicting in its gameplay that I am okay with putting a little money into it. I may end up buying some coins at some point just so I can keep playing, because I feel like, you know, that's the point of this. That's why they're doing this. This is why they're giving me a free game, is like, hey, if you really enjoy it, give us $5 and we'll let you play another, you know, month or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I did that same thing with Dragon Age Legends. I have no problem with that, especially if you find that the game is consuming so much of your time and you're enjoying it, like, why not just, like, throw $5 their way to support,
you know? I mean, dude, it took over Minecraft. It took over reading. Like, I sit at work, or I don't sit at work, but, like, I sit at going to work on the train playing this game every day back and forth. I'll play it at night sometimes when I'm laying in bed or sitting on the couch. Like I'll pull up my phone and start playing this game. It's a really fun, addicting game. I don't know if it's on iOS. I wouldn't be shocked if it was.
Mm-hmm. I think it is.
It is on iOS. So it's on iOS and Android.
It's on Google Plus as well.
It's a ton of fun. Definitely recommended. It's called Triple Town. It's by Spry Fox. Apparently you can get it on just about any platform you want to get it on. And I'm going to do a little roundup with the games that I've been playing lately, including Minecraft and this, so should be on the site soon. I'm behind up writing.
But, cool.
Yeah. So there you go.
Good deal. All right. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with our open thread question, which was, have you ever met one of your idols? Would you want to? If so, was it everything you ever hoped and dreamt of? Mm-hmm.
We are back with our Twitter question. We asked everybody, I guess this is like the fourth time we'll say it, but we will say it again because it's a good question. We said, have you ever met one of your idols? Would you want to? And if so, was it everything you ever hoped for? And who was it?
I think I think I know some of your guys' answers already, but I'm eager to hear you tell the stories again because they're pretty good. But we had some pretty good Twitter responses to this one, and we always, again, appreciate when you guys reply to this. So every time you check your Twitter feed and you see us ask this, please, please give a response, and we will generally read them on the episode, and you will be immortalized.
Indeed.
Yes.
In digital bits.
Let's go ahead and dig in and start with some of these great answers. So Tiffany, who is at Aurora Borealis.
I think it's clever because if you put the ampersand before it, it looks like it Aurora. Says Aurora
Borealis, which is pretty cool. Yeah,
clever. So
at Aurora Borealis, if you want to add her. It says, by the time I met Maritza Campos and spent time with her, we were already online friends. Better because I didn't act like a fangirl. That's cool. I had to look up who this person
was. I
was
going to say, I don't know who this person is.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot like that.
Well, of course, yeah. You
know, nerds are nerds for all different reasons. And like, I'm pretty well versed in nerdy stuff, but there's always new people who I have no freaking clue who they are. Mm-hmm. But she's actually a cartoonist, if I looked up the right Maritza Campos. Either that or she's a housewife that lives in Southern California.
I think you may have been right the first time.
The cartoonist, then?
What did she what did she cartoon?
It looks sort of like it's gonna sound like a total noobish thing here, but it kind of looked like a Doonesbury-esque cartoon strip that was very like topical and well written. But I didn't read too many of them, so. But anyway, so Aurora Borealis says Maritza Campos, and that is kind of important. Like, it's cool that in today's day and age, you can actually establish. I don't want to say relationships, but you can actually get to know some of the people that you admire, you know, via Twitter or via their blog. So it doesn't feel like if you ever do encounter this person that you're kind of walking into them blindly. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is really cool.
I guess we'll read Ryan's response.
Sure.
Who is physics for poets.
But we know him as Bobalian.
Bobalian.
Yeah.
He says, I got to meet you guys when I guessed it on the podcast. Dream come true.
Thanks, Ryan. Moving on.
Which is a lie, because that's a goddamn lie, because I've known Ryan since
high school.
Right before high school.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I've known Ryan since high school, so
has he always been the same?
Yeah. A little bit. So.
He's way more sure of himself now while simultaneously not being sure of himself. So like in high school he was a little more nerdy, like less of an asshole, I think, than now. He's grown into his assholeness, which is fine. We tell each other we're assholes all the time. It's okay.
What does it tell you about him that his Twitter icon is Charlie Sheen?
It's he went on some like weird thing where like Charlie Sheen was like on his Facebook and was his Twitter icon, and yeah.
still living that.
I think he likes that. I think he likes watching people just completely disintegrate. So,
yeah, indeed. Scott, have you thought about your answer yet?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about using the word idol, but getting to meet Tim Rose, who was the puppeteer for Admiral Akbar, was pretty incredible. Matt was with me. We met him at Celebration last year. And I don't know how other people feel about this, but to answer the question, would you want to? I think that really what it boils down to is that you're kind of terrified that the person that you would really like to meet doesn't turn out to be an asshole.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's really your greatest fear, is that like you spend all this time like following this person or reading their material or watching like their art or whatever they do. And then you meet them and they genuinely seem disinterested in like you as a fan. And I think that's really the major fear, is that you don't want to be disappointed by meeting these people.
Yeah.
In the case of Tim Rose, it was completely not a disappointment. And he was the nicest guy. He would, you know, like he spent time talking to us. He was interested in like memorabilia that I brought for him to sign. He took a picture. Like
Multiple pictures. Didn't he take like two or three with you?
Yeah, he took a couple of pictures, and he was a guy who was, you know, not so super famous where it was like, oh, a picture costs $20. Yeah. Like, you can't touch me in the picture. You know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He was super nice.
Just, like, Yeah, he got up from behind the desk and was like, "Hey, you want to take a picture? This will be awesome. Here, hold your doll in your hand, and we'll do it. You know, we'll take the picture with the autograph I just signed for you."
And I do like that the Admiral Akbar bust is directly behind your head in the video shot while you're talking
about. Oh yeah,
yeah. And for listeners, Scott, by the way, is like the biggest Admiral Akbar fan probably in the East Coast of the United States. So.
Yeah, when you're talking about minimal screen time in Star Wars films, a lot of people go with Boba Fett, and I decided to go with Admiral Akbar.
He also told me when we went to Star Tours, we watched it twice, and he said that the first time he went, I guess Admiral Akbar showed up in it, and he yelled out, he gave like a fanboy like, "Yay!" Like what happened?
in the middle of the vehicle filled with like 30 other people, I was just like, "Yeah!" You
know? Oh, amazing. So,
yeah.
Yes, so, Tim Rose, and I can validate that statement. Tim Rose was one of the nicest people. He was super just interested and cool and very awesome to deal with. It was really neat. So
yeah, totally normal dude.
Yeah,
good deal.
Where did we leave off?
Justin Banks at Midtown 583 said, "Met both LeVar Burton and Bruce Campbell at Comic-Con, and it was worth meeting guys I've seen in movies and TV. Totally nerded out." So that's cool. It's good.
Those guys are frequent convention folks. So if you're a Bruce Campbell or a LeVar Burton fan, they pretty much attend a couple of those a year. So they're pretty well versed at meeting fans.
Yeah.
It's cool that these people are aware of the fact that they are like loved in certain cultures. You know what I mean? And like they're okay with it. You kind of have to embrace it. You have to feel like if you're going to go into like a nerdy like sort of like area, that you just need to be aware of the fact that the fans are probably going to be a little different than mainstream fans, you know?
All right. Let's see. So we have, that was a good one, Justin. Thank you as always. Here's a rather dark one. This is from at Uchi Haboro. I think I said that right. At Uchi Haboro. Yes. At Uchi Haboro says, "The idea of man itself is awesome, but once you meet him, you realize that he is like any of us." That's deep.
But isn't that what you want?
Yeah. But then there was a frown face.
A level of idealism that I think you instill in your idols that you kind of don't want. You want them to be something better. You know, like you want to meet George Lucas and have him just be like some kind of crazy genius who just...
Oh, yeah. We did use the word idol and not just celebrity.
Yeah, yeah. So. Like your idols should sit at a level, like I think in your brain they should sit at a level above where you know, or whatever.
Like they should smell nice all the time. Yeah. Right, like when you're around them. Yeah,
well I think the word idol makes it seem like something that you would aspire to do or be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
yeah, absolutely. But yeah, once you meet them and you realize they're just like you, or that can be both positive or negative. I agree with this comment. I mean, it is nice to kind of hold them up high, but
yeah,
it's kind of scary.
Matt, do you have an answer to this Twitter question?
Well, first I wanted to see what Ash thought mine was.
Oh, I was going to say when you guys both opened up for Helmet.
Oh.
I was thinking that was on top of the list.
I have a bunch
of... And that actually went very positively.
Yeah, yeah. I have a bunch of music ones that are like... None of them were super idols, but Helmet would have been. So yeah, that's probably a really good one. So yeah... You know, as Ash likes to make fun of us for on occasion, Scott and I talk about being in a band a lot. Yeah. And one of the awesome, we went on a tour and on our way back, we had booked a show in Orlando to open for the band Helmet, which was, you know, a band that's been around since the late 80s and was literally an idol of mine, a band that I've listened to for pretty much since I've listened to music. And were a huge influence on the band that we were in. And, so the ironic thing is we had to drive from North Carolina to Orlando, Florida to make the show in time. So we had to do about a 14-hour drive to make it to the show. We showed up, and then on the way there, the other piece of it is that on the way there, we got called by the venue and told that we were no longer opening. We were like halfway.
Yeah.
We had canceled like two other shows. We were halfway there and they were like, "Oh, sorry, it's canceled." And I was like, "What?" And I freaked out and I started calling all these people and getting mad at people. And we worked our way back onto the show and we show up and we kind of load in, and the other band who was supposed to open was kind of giving us nasty looks, who they still played, but I don't think they were super happy that we were there. And we set up, we sound test and we do all our stuff and then our sound check. And Everybody was being super nice to us. We didn't meet Paige Hamilton at that point. He was there for our sound check, and then he disappeared back to the bus or whatever. And show goes on. We play. Helmet gets on and starts playing. I watched one song and was so exhausted from the drive that I went out to the van and slept through the rest of the Helmet set.
Yeah.
And Melissa came out to the van and like knocked on the door and like pulled me out. She's like, "You have to come back in. They're almost done." And I was like, "All right." And I went back inside and I watched one song and it was fun. I mean, he was not the best Helmet show, but it was fun to play such a tiny venue with them. And then Hamilton at the end of it stuck around and said hi to all of us and like was, you know, gave us all like handshakes and hugs and told us that we were awesome and he really loved us during sound check and like was just super complimentary and just a really nice guy the whole time. And actually his whole crew and his whole band were super nice to us and like very welcoming because we thought we were going to show up and get kind of shunned because no one really wanted us there. And then we showed up and what ended up happening was all of the bands, with the exception of one, were super awesome and super welcoming and like loved our stuff. And it just was a really cool experience. So it was, awesome. It was good to meet that idol. And kind of have that sort of.
It's always nerve wracking though, because it could totally go the other way, you know.
It could.
It totally go.
And I've had it go the other way with other bands that I really like that I've met and been like, oh, okay, cool. Well, I'll never talk to you again.
It makes you kind of not like that band very much, isn't that? That's the risk. Yeah. Like when you meet these people that you hold in such a high regard, you know, and they turn out to be a douche. You're like, oh. Yeah. I don't really have any desire to support you or your career anymore, unfortunately. Yeah. All right. So let's see. We have a couple more here. We have at, oh, how do I say this?
Foxeezy?
Foxeezy. At Foxeezy says, "I have met my idol. It was all I hoped for in that I didn't wet myself or get arrested. Total embarrassment otherwise." He didn't mention who his idol was, but it can be. There have been a lot of occurrences as like a convention guy, especially like in the early days of conventions. My very first convention, I met Q from Star Trek, who is John DeLancey. And that was at a convention in Fort Myers when I was like 11 years old. And I remember being terrified of meeting Q from Star Trek. And it gets easier after your first couple of meetings.
You also mentioned that you were a blurter too, that you are a blurter, right?
I still am a blurter. I'll say anything to anyone and it can get me in trouble, but you know, most of the time I think people that are in have a public, you know, people who are in the eye of the public, they actually kind of rather have you talk to them as a human being and not like freak out, you know, and like fawn all over them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just generally say whatever's on my mind and hopefully they don't mind hearing it. So, which is cool.
Last up, we've got at Thesair. Chris says, "Oh, yes, Lewis Gossett Jr., Dragon Con 07. My brain still refuses to process it. An incredible man." I have one question for this. Why was Lewis Gossett Jr. at Dragon Con?
Yeah.
That's a weird con film.
I don't know.
Isn't it?
Was there another Iron Eagle film that I'm not aware of? Iron Eagle 7?
I
don't know.
He's credited as Half-Life 2.
Oh, well, yeah. He's the voice of the guy and half the dad. What's his name?
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's the scientist whose daughter runs around with Gordon.
I didn't know.
And he was in a few episodes of Stargate SG-1.
That probably is why. Then, do you remember how recognizable that he was? Like the Morgan Freeman of like the mid to late 90s. Like his voice was just everywhere. Yeah. You could recognize him in a minute. Like you always knew Lewis Gossett Jr.'s voice.
Yes, he was pretty much everywhere. Yeah, I mean, it's cool. The thing about this question that's kind of neat is everyone has like such diverse answers, you know, such weird, like, I mean, Scott likes Admiral Akbar. I mean, that's just like, you know what I mean? And like, here's a guy who's like loves Lewis Gossett Jr. It's just so, it's so random. And like, we kind of cling to our idols sort of like, you know, we have this weird ownership over them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of strange.
Ash, did you formally answer this question? No.
I didn't. The reason I actually posed this question is because last weekend, the weirdest thing in the fucking world happened to me. So I, the reason we didn't do the podcast, one was Matt was traveling, the other I was traveling, and we talked about at the beginning how I flew out to Denver And I met my my best friend out there mainly for a show. So we went and saw Hot Water Music and the Descendants at a really nice venue out in Denver. And we were only there for like 2.5 days. And, you know, it was an expensive trip. It was kind of a on the spur of the moment trip. But this band, the Descendants, to put it in perspective for people that don't know them, and no, I'm not talking about the George Clooney film that's out. I had people ask me, why did you fly to Denver to see a George Clooney film? It's not the George Clooney film. It's an old punk band. But they've been pretty much my favorite band since I was about 15 or 16 years old. I can like vividly remember when I first got their album. I remember like, you know, that band was, you know, they played their music at my wedding. They're just a really important part of my life, and they don't play very often at all because most of the guys in the band have gone on to do different things. And the lead singer Milo is a, he's a
doctor,
he's like a biologist at like a, you know, some, you know, wherever biologists work. Where do biologists work, Scott?
Biologists.
Yes. So we watched the show. It was awesome. And, you know, my wife and I are flying home on the plane. And we were flying on U.S. Air. And U.S. Air is pretty notorious for, you know, just doing really goofy stuff with your seats. So we were separated on the flight home, which was a pretty, like, 3.5 hour flight before the layover. And so she's sitting far away from me, and I'm sitting like on one side of the plane. And then I kind of look up, and walking down the aisle towards me is the lead singer of the Descendants, Milo. And I'm like, I look over to Christina. I'm like, Christina, Milo's on this plane. And to the right of me is an empty seat, and to the left of her is an empty seat.
Wow.
And like, I'm watching the plane kind of fill up, and he's like fumbling around with his bags and stuff like that. And lo and behold, he like walks over and sits in the seat next to me. And here I am, and I'm not shitting you. I have a Descendants hoodie on that I had purchased at the show. And I'm like, and I don't really, because I, like I said, I go to conventions and stuff all the time, so I don't get nervous really that often anymore. It doesn't really happen. But I was fucking nervous because I was like, this is a guy like over half my life that I've like loved, like everything that this band sings about. And they're just, you know, my favorite band, my favorite singer. And I just kind of looked over at him with my hoodie, and I was just like, well, this is kind of awkward. And he saw the Descendants logo, and I just gushed. I gushed for like 10 minutes. I was like, I don't think you understand. Like, I don't think you understand. Like, you know how, like, you went to college? You were like this like punk kid, and you went to college. Like, I did the same thing. I'm like, I'm a school teacher now. It's all because of you, Milo. And he's just like shaking his head, like, oh, shut the fuck up. but we talked for quite a while, and he was really, really nice and talked about his family. And, you know, it's like really like felt like I got to know the guy for a little bit. And, I ended up leaving him alone after a while because I didn't want to like torture him, just like geeking out. But such a nice dude, and you know, it was a random, totally bizarro experience, but it was amazing. So, a lot of fun. Yeah, definitely. Everybody that listens to this, go check out the Descendants. They're great.
Cool.
So that's it.
That's it. Episode 48.
We did it.
Another successful survived. Podcast.
Thank you guys for listening. As always, we are Nerd Appropriate. You can find us at Nerd Appropriate on Twitter. And what are some other places?
Facebook.com/Nerd Appropriate. You can go to the wasteland that is Google Plus and search for Nerd Appropriate and see that we have still not yet posted anything to it. And we will maintain that as an empty account until we die. And
I would also like to encourage people to, if you like or don't like something about our podcast, please comment in the post on the podcast so that we can better serve your needs, I suppose. Or just let us know if you like it. Yeah.
As always, head to iTunes and give us a rating and give us a comment. If you don't give us a comment, at least give us a rating, which is the most simple thing to do in the world. You just click the 5-star, because if you don't click 5 stars, I don't get paid. And then it's my favorite thing to say, because it's like the used car salesman. They're like, you're going to get a survey, and if I don't get 5 out of 5, then I get fired. And I'm like, well, then why is there a survey? Like, who cares?
Yeah.
Anyways. So.
All right, we'll see you guys next week with a whole bunch of fun stuff. So, have an excellent week, everybody.
Goodbye.
See ya.